Now live from Everbank Field, 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your host Mike Dempsey and Jeff Lagerman.
All right, glad everybody's with us here on a Tuesday to kick things off on Jaguars Today with Jeff Lagerman. The professor is in to review the film one final time for the 2015 season. I guess 2015/16. They did play this calendar year. Jeff, was it the worst film of the year overall? Was it? I mean, look, it wasn't the biggest margin of defeat of the year, but in all things considered, was this the most disappointing film, I guess, from a Jaguars standpoint to watch?
Yes. I mean, yes, both offense, defense, all that special teams was pretty good. But offense up front, I mean, there wasn't a chance. I mean, there was no chance to function at any level whatsoever and be effective as an offense. Start with Luke Jokel. I mean, the worst game that he's ever played yet. And I mentioned to you that it's a shame that he has a game like that to end the season on, because if you looked at his first 15 games, you would say he took a step up. He got better than he did from 2015.
How big of a step?
2014.
Was it marginal?
Marginal or? Step, you know. Okay.
Heading in the right direction.
Heading in the right direction, you're like, okay, good, you know, serviceable. Okay, we can win with him. And then to leave on that note was just terrible, you know, and he reverted back to the form that he had back in 2014, where the head starts to drop, the feet stop moving, and against a guy in Whitney Mercilus that, you know, is a good player, but he's not a great player. You know, I can understand it against J.J. Watt. I mean, J.J. Watt is J.J. Watt. He's a great player. But, you know, in that game, Sam Young struggled against J.J. Watt early. Sam Young settled down. You know, Luke Jokel struggled from beginning to end, and it never stopped.
It seemed like we were kind of half joking about it, like Watt was looking at Mercilus putting up all those numbers and decided to tap him on the shoulder.
Let me get over there.
Let me head on over to the right side. And then he did his thing against Jokel as well.
Yeah, I mean, when the turnstile is spinning free,
everybody wants a shot at it.
Heck yeah.
Can they win? Is Luke Jokel an issue for this football team? Or in your opinion, and also what you think Dave Caldwell's opinion is, I'm sure he'll get asked about Luke Jokel today.
Sure he will. Here's the thing. The top two draft picks of your first draft class had bad games.
Bad game for Jonathan Cyprian as
bad
well.
Bad games.
Yeah.
Bad games. And so Dave will get asked that today, and rightly so. And can you win with Luke Jokel at left tackle? Yes, you can win with Luke Jokel at left tackle. Can you get better at left tackle? Possibly. But I don't think you go out and you spend a high draft pick to get better at that spot. I think if it happens organically, to use a word, if Josh Wells beats him out, so be it. You know, so
you wouldn't prioritize bringing in competition for Luke Jokel.
Now, you can't discount what happened in the first 15 games and make a one-game evaluation on Luke Jokel. But you can certainly, and here's the best thing that might have happened, is that game. You know, maybe that game serves as motivation to Luke Jokel that, look, what I have been is not good enough for this football team, and maybe it will provide, you know, the old picture article that you have in the bathroom mirror where you wake up every day and you go to brush your teeth and you look at that article that says, 5 sacks allowed in last game, that provides you the motivation that you need to get better and you need to do everything that is possible under your realm of physical being to be a better player.
What kind of job did Doug Marrone do with the offensive line this year, in your opinion?
I think he did a good job. But I think that Dave Caldwell and his staff did the best job. You know, I don't want to, because I think it's easy to say, well, okay, you change the offensive line coach, and it was all him. Well, no, you got better play out of Zane Beatles, which was that Doug Marrone? Probably, but you upgraded the personnel at center, you upgraded the personnel at right tackle, then you also got years under the belt from experience from Brandon Linder, from Luke Jokel, also from Zane Beatles, and the same thing. But then you also upgraded it in the draft with AJ Cann. So, yeah, I think Doug Marrone did a good job. But I also think that the personnel department did a really good job there, because, as we said, kind of coming out of the preseason, that the number one and the number two offensive line pick either one of them. Either one of them are probably better than what they had the previous year.
Doug Marrone said to be a candidate for the Cleveland head coaching job, and maybe others. We'll see as the process plays out. Gus Bradley was asked about it yesterday. Said he definitely would like to have him back and anticipates him returning if he doesn't get a head coaching gig somewhere else. Is that your expectation, that if he doesn't move on to a head coaching job, that he's likely back at O-line, or do you have that enough insight into that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's I don't know what the terms of his contract are. I don't know how many years it is, you know, so, I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, that's going to be the number one determining factor, what's the situation of his contract, because, you know, first of all, if he gets a head job, he's gone.
Of course.
Number two is that, let's say somebody says, hey, we want you to be the offensive coordinator, assistant head coach, and we're going to pay you $1 million a year. I don't know what he's getting paid here, and I don't know what the offset is from the job that he had in Buffalo. Was, you know, did the buyout include payment for 2016? So, that's probably going to be a, you know, much like in free agency, show me the money. You know, show me the money is a factor with coaches as well.
All right. Jeff Loggeman is here. If you want to get in today, you know the way to do it, or the ways to do it. 641-1010 is the phone number. It's also the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line. Our question today is this. We always talk about keys to victory. We're talking about keys to the offseason today. What, in your opinion, as a Jaguar fan, should the Jaguars' top three priorities be in terms of trying to improve for 2016 this offseason? You can join us on Twitter at MD_1010XL, at Logs56, LOGS56, and at 1010XL Fat Tony. And, of course, the Jaguars Today Facebook page is open for business as well. We'll take plenty of your calls if you're so inclined throughout the next 2 hours. We'll also hear extensively from Gus Bradley as he wrapped up the season with his thoughts, as Dan Hicken said, at a 36-minute presser yesterday, covering just about all the bases. All that coming up and more. It's Jaguars Today on this Tuesday morning, live on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
It's going to be a bright season for us. I can feel the energy of this team, and no matter what the outside may see or whatever they may think, we know what's going to happen. When it comes, it's going to come fast. It's going to be a takeover.
That's Aaron Colvin. Jags are taking over in 2016. Hey, it's 2016. Start taking over. Let's do it. January 5th. Got a long way to go, and hopefully a lot of reinforcements on the way.
Well, talk is cheap.
It is, right?
Talk is real cheap. And, you know, Aaron Colvin's a guy that's got to step his game up. I thought his game throughout the course of the season leveled out to slightly declined.
What was that due to, if you could tell?
I don't know. You know, I don't know if it was physical. You know, I don't know if it was, you know, the first time ever, you know, I mean, because that's his first NFL season.
Full season, yeah, sure.
You know, so getting used to the rigors and the physical demands of playing an NFL season. But, you know, his guy last year, at this point, me and you were talking, I was telling you, he's going to be starter next year. And he's got that kind of physical ability. And the last, you know, month of the season, month and a half of the season, it's been kind of okay. Now, he makes some plays, you know, at the nickel spot. He's a very good blitzer. Does a good job on that, 4 sacks. He had a couple tackles for a loss this past game. But his performance on the outside has to be better than what it is. How many interceptions did he have?
Any? One?
Let me look.
Was it one?
None.
None. That would not be very good.
No, I mean, it's, you know,
playmaking.
I mean, he's a guy that has the ability to make plays. From what I understand and everything that I'm told, he is an excellent leader. He practices very hard, you know, but he's got to be able to take another step.
This whole team is it just so simply a lack of pressure up front that leads to a lack of opportunities to create turnovers,
well,
you know, particularly
interceptions?
I think
it's, well, you always hear the coach speak about rush cover, you know, and that they got to work hand in hand. And I think that you almost got to a point this year where there was no rush, and then as a defensive backfield, you feel like, well, even if we're at our best, what's it going to get us? You know what I mean? And then you almost feel helpless sometimes in the back end, because you don't have the confidence that if we perform well, then it's going to happen up front. And I, you know, that's when you want to have some guys step up in the back end and say, we don't care. We don't care what the rush is. We don't care how long the quarterback has to throw the ball. We're going to be at our best. This secondary was not at their best. At the end of the season here, too many times we saw, And a perfect example is the third down that Grimes caught the ball on the sweet little out route that scored the touchdown. I think it was like third and nine, and it was somewhere right around the 14-yard line, something like that. And it looked or appeared to be man coverage. Jonathan Cyprian is on the inside. The Jaguars' Bob Babbage dials up a blitz. And here comes the blitz, and Cyprian hesitates for a second on the vertical route and is late getting to Grimes on the out route. And Grimes dives ahead, sticks the ball over the plane of the goal line, touchdown. Well, you can't hesitate. You know, as a defensive back, that's the difference between making a play and allowing a play. You have to know exactly what your responsibility is without question, and it becomes instinctual, if that's even a word. The instincts have to take over, and you're taking that step before it even happened.
So Grimes should have been Cyprian's guy, because it did look like, and it appeared to me like that was the case, but it did look like body language-wise, you kind of turned to Dwayne Grotz, like, where were you that they were unsure whose guy was whose, or at least Cyprian was unsure.
And that's my point.
Right. Well, so do you think that, I mean, was that Cyprian's guy?
Could be, but I think it was Cyprian's guy, but I don't know for sure, but I do know this. Somebody didn't know what they were supposed to do.
Somebody didn't know, right, exactly.
Right? And that's what, week 17?
You know, how does that happen, Jeff?
The week before against New Orleans Saints when you got Brandon Cooks running a crossing route, you know, communication thing. Remember that Gus was talking about that in his press conference the day after. Brandon Cooks is running wide open on a third down opportunity. Well, look, number 10 for the Saints is their main guy. You know, somebody's got to be on him. I mean, things like that. If they make a better play than you, that's fine, because that happens. They get paid to. But when they make a play when you're not in position to even contest a ball, and because you're not even in the same zip code, I mean, that's a problem.
This on the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line. I hear that safety is a big need for us. What happened to James Sample? Where does he figure into our future? There's been a lot of talk about Jalen Ramsey, right, coming out of Florida State, possibly being a selection of the Jags with the fifth pick, come in, be a playmaking free safety, sideline to sideline, that whole thing. Could you envision a scenario like that, whether it's he or some other guy, the Jags spending an early pick on a safety and then saying, okay, we've got Sample, we've got Cyprian, we've got new guy. Battle it out. Two of you better emerge.
I think it's going to be that way regardless of who they pick. I really do. I think next year James Sample is back. Josh Evans is back. You got Sergio Brown. You've also got some flexibility with Nick Marshall. Does Nick Marshall play corner, nickel, safety? Okay. And you're going to open it up. I mean, scholarships are over. It's time now to get to the bottom line, which is performance. And it's hard to make a switch in season to where we say, okay, the competition is now open again. They tried to do that at some different times, and it was mainly with the nickel corner position because they've been playing that all year long. This offseason, I think there's going to be some guys that may get moved around a little bit, and it's going to be open competition. If it's Jonathan Cyprian and James Sample for the strong position, open competition, let's roll. Let's see what happens.
Are you a believer that safety, though, is a priority, that they need to add safety, or could in your mind, can you go in with the group that you have? And
well, you got to get better. I mean, you got to get better. And the only way you're going to get better is to create competition and get better talent and better coaching. I think you got to get all three of them. Now, is safety the priority over the front or the linebacker? No, I think it depends upon what's available when they're picking. But you need help at all three levels. You need guys that can rush. You need linebackers that have speed, like Telvin Smith, which, well, let me correct myself. You need a linebacker that has close to Telvin Smith's speed, because nobody has Telvin Smith's speed, you know? And then you need help in the back end. You need help at all three levels on defense. Give me the best player available at any of those three levels. And then once you get to round two, then you look at what's left. And then you say, okay, this is – best we've got at the other levels that we're looking at, and I'll take that guy. And then you get to the third round, and you say, you know what? I'm going to take the best available at any of those three levels, and then we're going to take it, we're going to roll. And then the nice thing is, with the free agent situation the way it is and the cap room that you have, you're going to be able to probably add to some of those levels before you get to the draft, and it will allow you to go to what Dave Caldwell typically has not done in the past, but that's draft best available player. But best available player at positions, not position, positions of need.
See, but you don't think, though, depending on how the draft goes, if they don't, if they, like, if an offensive lineman in first round, second round is their highest graded player on the board, you think they should still go defense regardless?
Well, not necessarily. It depends on what the difference of the grade is. You know,
if it's right. So you're saying if it's close enough.
It's close. You know, let's say you got a guy who's a 6.1 grade and the one's a 6.05. You know, to me, you take the position of need. You know,
right. Well, that's basically a tie. But I mean, I guess the question becomes what margin does one guy have to be better than the other guy? And what do you consider positions of need? And certainly we understand the needs on the defensive side of the football. You don't think often, I mean, you think Tyler Shatley is going to be starting on this line at some point.
I think he is going to compete at an extremely high level, and I believe he will be a starter somewhere.
Parnell and Linder are going to start, right? On your right side. Okay?
Yes.
Or in one of the spots for Linder. They're two starters. You don't know about center yet. He may not be on the roster. He may be on the roster.
Shatley is in the mix right there, absolutely. You know, because Shatley started out the preseason as pretty much a guard, and then that was it. And then because of, I think, you know, Wisniewski's shoulder, Bowanko, if I remember right, got a little injury in the preseason, and then you had really nobody else that could do it, and they put Tyler Shatley in at center, and you're like, oh, my. Oh, my. This guy can play, you know, center, which is hard. I think he's in the mix. I would not be surprised whatsoever if he is the starting center next year. He is incredibly strong. Weight room strong, football strong. You know, I was telling you guys that he had one snap on offense. The third and one that Jonas Gray was able to convert, he was the wing in that formation, and he has to block John Simon, who was getting the start over the injured Jadeveon Clowney. And John Simon spins him, tries to go inside, spins back to the outside. Shatley stays on the block and literally at one point is on his knee and is getting extension with his right arm to keep John Simon off balance to allow Jonas Gray to run through that tackle to get the first down. That kind of effort and that kind of strength is going to have a major impact on your running game. Got to have him somewhere.
What do you do with Zane Beatles? Bring him back, open competition, may the best man win?
No.
You don't bring him back?
Nope.
Okay. So who's your starting guard next year? Can. Okay.
Yep.
So Can, Shatley, Linder.
Now, see, I don't know where it's
Parnell. Going.
And see, here's the question is Linder and Can, okay? Can, what, 51 starts at left guard at South Carolina, but he's a short, powerful guy, okay? Is it best to leave him or to put him back where he has 51 starts where he got it at South Carolina at left guard? Or is it best to leave him at that right guard position, which is typically most teams are right-handed when they run the football, and he's got power, and then maybe Linder provides a level of toughness and settles down Luke Jokel on the other side and helps make Luke Jokel better? That's an interesting conversation.
Is Luke Jokel how do you treat him? Do you say – you're coming back and it's an open job, everyone's battling for the left tackle position, you know, equally? Or
well, this isn't, you know, first of all, it's interesting because it's Dave Caldwell's first draft pick, you know. Dave,
I understand. Dave, hey, that we're talking that whole first draft right now is looking a little shaky.
Well, it, you know, after that last game in Houston, now
well, Denard Robinson didn't exactly inspire a lot of confidence down the stretch this year.
And Dwayne Grotz,
Dwayne Grotz had become an afterthought in a lot of ways.
Sanders
is gone. Right.
Josh Evans been a good pick.
So for a sixth rounder, he's been a very solid guy.
Very good pick.
You know, but I mean, you're talking about finding a couple of solid guys late. That's not exactly what you're looking for.
Year three, you want to see those guys take a major step up. You know, and
didn't happen.
I think, you know, here's the thing: we saw flashes. You know, we saw a couple games that John Cyprian had. We were like, I mean, the game in London. Wow, he had like I think two other games where you went, wow, this guy is coming on. But then all of a sudden you have those games, you know, the ups and downs, you know. It's like the crazy stock market sometimes. I mean, all of a sudden you get a performance, you're like, what the hell was that?
Right, and it's one thing if you're getting eight of those up, and then eight, you know, maybe four, and then
you're
four
gonna have,
bad ones.
You're going to have games as a defensive back to where you have, you know, games that you look like a star, and then you're going to have games that you kind of disappear. But you don't want to have games that you disappear to you know, down below the radar to where you're making plays that are negative and just – you know, glaring, bad play, bad play, bad play. You know, and I think Cyprian has had a couple of those moments. I'm not saying that he has been terrible, because he hasn't been terrible. But the consistency with Jonathan Cyprian, it has to be better.
So you're saying, in terms of Luke Jokel, if I'm reading you correctly, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, he may get that extra consideration because he is the first pick of the regime.
I think he's gotten that all along. You know, and that's natural. That happens. You know, I mean, he was the anointed left tackle.
Draft picks
get
and more of an opportunity because you have more invested in them. But at this point, now going into season four, coming off, and I understand one game can't wipe out everything, but look, like you were saying throughout the season, he's kind of an average left tackle. He's playing himself into an average left tackle, which you can live with, but it'd be one thing if he had been playing, you know, at an above average level most of the year and then had run really atrocious game. Obviously, a lot of people are going to be looking at that position and see if there's competition created. So, bottom line, he walks in as the incumbent starter.
I think any time you come back, because he did make progress. He is an average to slightly above average left tackle. Can you win with him? Yes, you can. And I think that when you come in this year, he's your starting left tackle. Okay, no problem there, starting left tackle. But it goes without saying that competition is always there. Josh Wells is going to provide some competition at left tackle for him. I thought Josh Wells got significantly better before he had the thumb injury. And he spent all year on injured reserve. He's going to have another year now removed from college to be able to improve physically. And if Josh Wells all of a sudden comes out in off-season training camp and starts to look better, at some point you gotta ignore he was my first
the pedigree, yeah,
my first pick,
yeah,
okay. And then at some point that will happen, but I'm not saying that that's going to happen as far as he's going to get.
But you've
got
to have the environment where it's allowed to happen. Don't
Absolutely,
you?
That's the environment to success.
All right, Jeff Loggeman is here. That is our environment for success here on Jaguars Today every Tuesday. Fat Tony, Mike Dempsey here with you as well. We'll get to Gus Bradley's comments from yesterday's press conference. And if you'd like to get in with a question or 10 for Jeff Loggeman, 641-1010 is the phone number. It's Jaguars Today live at Everbank on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Loggeman, brought to you by Roland Reich Plumbing on Jaguars Today. 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
It's been rough, you know. We definitely had some ups and downs. But looking at the tape, you know, it's a lot of things I can get better at. You know, and as a unit, it's a lot of things we can get better at, of course, and as a defense and as a team. You know, that's what this offseason for, to reset, get our mind right, because next year we really shouldn't be any excuse why we should be an AFC South Division champs.
You can say that about this year, in my book, you know, the way the division played out, but you know, I think with everything that fell on the line, Tony and I have talked about this a lot, Jeff. The backup quarterbacks they faced, the way the schedule fell, the teams that looked maybe more fearsome when the season began and didn't turn out to be that way, I think they grossly underachieved this year. I think this team could have easily, maybe should have been an 8-win team, maybe a 9-win team when all was said and done. And look, I understand you're not going to win every close game, but I just felt like they didn't capitalize on enough opportunities. Is that the bar? What is the bar when Shad Khan says, and that happened just after we went off last week, Shad put the statement out, and to paraphrase, he said basically everyone understands there needs to be significant improvement at this point next year. What is it? Do you think he has a number in mind, or is it you'll know it when you see it kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's a great question for Shad, but I mean, and I think most people's expectations are that this team needs to be competing for the division title, competing for a playoff spot, realistically.
Right. Not competing because the division fell apart around you.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's a realistic expectation. And Ryan Davis said there's no reason why we shouldn't be division champs. You know, go back to the same thing and my same response with Aaron Colvin's statement. Talk is cheap. Talk is cheap.
Go do it. It's Ryan Davis well-suited in the role that they're using him in? Because, you know, there's a lot. He's maybe the single guy that gets mentioned by the fans to Tony and myself more than anyone else in terms of we got to see more of this guy, right? Because the pass rush obviously wasn't as effective as anywhere close to where they want it to be. And I think the feeling is Ryan Davis, if you play him more as an every down Leo, he's going to wear down against the run.
I don't buy that. I don't. You know, I've been heard people say that before. I don't buy it. He's no different than anybody else physically. He's not going to wear down. I'm not saying that he deserves to have 50 snaps a game on defense. You know, the problem this year is that you've got a guy in a limited role in Andre Branch, okay, who did not give you a level of production that you would like to see out of the Leo. And if Andre Branch is limited reps and Ryan Davis is limited reps, why can't Andre Branch be on special teams, right? I mean, because that's kind of what you're trying to, compute, okay, balance. Okay, if Andre Branch is taking more snaps on defense, not going to be on special teams. Well, you know what? If you want to get Ryan Davis more snaps on defense.
Take some of his special team snaps.
Absolutely. If Andre Branch can't do it, get rid of Andre Branch and find somebody who will do it, right? I mean, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, or find somebody who can do it.
Why isn't Andre Branch on special teams anyway?
Well, what do you think the answer to that is?
I don't know.
Do you think maybe he just is not, in their mind, not suited to, you know, I don't know. There's got to be some reason, right? Or they feel like he gave them the best opportunity on more of an every down basis, you know, based on the options they had.
Right.
He's going to be more effective.
Well, maybe you
the
think
role
that going
played.
In, you know, when you're in the offseason, no pads and – you know, Andre Branch is running around real good and looking good, and, you know, which kind of last 2 years, it's what we've kind of heard, right? Coming out of off-season activities and out of the first part of training camp, he's had a really good camp. He's had a really good off-season. You know, I like Andre Branch.
What?
He gives great effort, but he doesn't play with knee bend. Doesn't play with
so
power.
So it's a technique issue for him.
It's a physical issue with him.
Define that.
He can't do it. I mean, he can't bend his knees and play with power. Ryan Davis plays bent knee, plays with power. That's why I've always – look, I'm not saying that Ryan Davis is your answer at Leo, because he's not. But he's more of an answer in a rotational situation than Andre Branch.
Than what they had. All right. Let's get to some of Gus Bradley's comments. Yesterday, spoke for 36 minutes to wrap up the Jaguars' 2015 campaign. And here's what he opened with.
With our team, I'll have a chance to meet with our players. We just had a team meeting, and I'd like to visit with our players and their exit interviews and also our coaches. And, you know, I've not had a chance to meet with either one of them yet. So until I get a chance to do that, I won't be able to provide any insight on what's taking place. But I think this offseason now we really need to dig deep. I think we go back and in the team meeting, we celebrate the victories, some of the things that took place, and there are some great accomplishments, you know, personal accomplishments, some unit accomplishments as we went through everything. But, you know, I think also the emphasis was on how much work needs to be done. And as a coaching staff, we got to dig deep. And, you know, our central theme is compete, and that's what we need to do this offseason. We've got a lot of areas that we can build on, some weaknesses that we've got to get straightened out. And that's what we'll devote all of our attention to.
What kind, in your opinion, what kind of a job has Gus Bradley done in his 3 years here in Jacksonville?
Well, I think that he did a really good job with the offense from last year to this year, and I think he needs to take the same type of approach with the defense, and that is I'm going to look at every option to improve our defensive side of the football. When he talks about competing, you have to compete as a coaching staff as well, and there's a lot of opportunities to be able to compete. You know, there's a lot of changes in the National Football League this year, and there's a lot of really good coaches that are out of work, and I'm not saying that you fire Bob Babich. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm saying that you look at improving that side of the ball from a coaching staff standpoint. If it's tweaking, if it's adjusting, if it's becoming more involved as a head coach on the defensive side of the ball and the day-to-day stuff, whatever that may be, you have to exhaust and explore every option that you have. Because right now, the simple fact is that the time is running out. That's it.
I mean, right, I understand.
That's the reality.
What option? I mean, look, we all sit here. Nobody wants to say, you know, Bob Babich, we would like to see this guy fired. He's a great guy. But the defense was woefully underperforming from what they needed to be this year. You can argue, did they have the personnel? You know, you can argue that till you're blue in the face. But if that were the case, you could probably say that about a lot of teams and coaches, whether they're position coaches, coordinators, head coaches, they get fired anyway because the buck eventually stops with them. Mm-hmm. What would you suggest? Would you tell Gus, if you were advising him, would you say you need to put your handprints all over this defense and go down swinging with that? Or you need to be open to maybe changing your philosophy if there's a great defensive coordinator out there and maybe run something different than what you feel is the proper way to do things? How would you approach it if you were advising Gus on fixing it?
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost that you have been building towards something as far as personnel-wise to this style of defense. Now, you can't just say, okay, we're going to change defenses completely. You just can't do that because the personnel that you've been acquiring for the last 3 years are built to play in this defense. I'm not saying that all of them are perfect fit, but you need to be able to make tweaks and adjustments in that system. You always do. I mean, and it's a percentage mix. You know, you might want to change certain things within your defense. Okay, let's say you've got five core defenses that, you know, you run 20% of the time equally. And if you have five core defenses and the personnel or the scheme is not working in a 20% or one category of that, then maybe you slant and play a different style to where instead of one style is 20% and 20%, you make one 10%, another one 25%, and the other one's 25%. So you have to tweak a defense. It's not like you can go ahead and just change the defense completely because they're running the things that other teams in the National Football League run. It's just a matter of what percentage of the mix it is. So I don't think you need to drastically change schemes or anything. I think you need to look at, is our leadership where it needs to be? Are we getting constant, never-ending improvement? Are we maximizing players' abilities? Are we getting the production out of players that we envisioned or that they're capable of? I think you look at everything. You look at the players. You look at the coaches. You look at the scheme. And I think that sometimes is hard to do. I mean, it's hard to do because it's that's your side of the ball. But I think if you're real, which I think that's the one trait that I think that Gus has, which is special, and that he has the ability to look at things from a different perspective and from an honest perspective. And it's very hard to do without egos being involved. And I think that's the one really great trait of Gus Bradley's, that his ego doesn't get in the way of making decisions. He's going to make the best decisions for the best interests of this team. And I think that he's going to address it. I think that he is going to make the right decisions. And I'm looking forward to him maximizing and competing the improvements that he can make.
Gus Bradley, wrapping up a disappointing 2015 season yesterday, was also asked how he viewed this season as a whole.
You know, you can get caught up in one side or the other. You can look at it and say, oh, boy, we had our opportunities and we just didn't get it done. And I think that there's some truth to that. And then there's the other side of me that looks and says, boy, I saw great progress being made. You know, really in all units, I saw, you know, offensively, you know, many stats, many figures show that there was improvement. Special teams, there's things that jumped out, punt return average, things like that. Even on defense, the run, you know, where we moved up from, I think at one time we were in the 20s to we were in the top five. So, you know, I think all those areas show improvement. But, you know, the results, like I said earlier, it's a results-driven league, and we're not to the results that we had hoped for. So, you know, I think that's what we need to look at.
Gus has to have better results, right? The team needs to have better results. If he's going to be around for 2017, he needs to have better results, whether that's making the playoffs, contending for the playoffs, whatever. Does the message, and I know you don't want to change who you are and you want to be consistent for the players, but does maybe not the message but the focus need to change? Because, Jeff, after 3 years, I know he believes in it, doing it this way, and maybe it will all come together this season, but this, you know, we hear the messages about learn from these mistakes and apply this and growing experience and focus on the process and all these things, and there's not much of that. Damn it, we need to win ball games, right? I mean, that you get from some coaches from time to time. And I'm not saying that makes you win ball games, no matter how many times you pound your fist on a podium. It's not going to make you win football games. But does he need to tweak his message at all for 2016?
I don't think he needs to tweak his message because I think his message just doesn't include what I think some people naturally want to see, which is the pounding the desk. You know, and what does the pounding the desk do? I mean, does it make for a better message? Does it make for a message that gets received better? Or does it gratify people that, oh, the coach is angry, you can tell that he's really going to be on them players?
But even beyond the public message, does this the sense of urgency maybe? I'm looking for the right way to phrase this. Does he need to communicate something differently to the players about, hey, you know, winning is always important, but now it's more critical than ever. If any of us are going to be there, they may blow the whole thing up.
I think, you know, he tries, and from just perception, my perception is that he tries to stay away from the winning conversation or wins and loss conversation because he has a belief that that can create anxiety. It can create the lack of performance when a player's not focusing on what he has to pay attention to, which is the task right in front of him and taking it step by step in the process.
Did Tom Coughlin have an issue creating anxiety? I mean, aren't some coaches putting you in that position?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to do it.
Right.
You know, there's different ways to do it. And you can still create anxiety or a pressure-type situation without disrupting performance. And I think that's a balance that he's got to be able to find. And I think that the better the roster gets, the more competition that you create, then that's an easier message, I think, to send than it is when there's not a lot of competition at certain positions. So that's the challenge for him, is to strike that balance of getting players to play freely and to play freely, but also to feel the sense of urgency. And that's a challenge.
He's Jeff Logman. I'm Mike Dempsey, along with Fat Tony. It's Jaguars Today on this Tuesday morning. Glad you're with us. Coming up next, we've got This State in Football, the Honda Drive around the NFL. Plenty more from Gus Bradley as well, wrapping up his thoughts on the season. Dave Caldwell will speak today, and I believe we'll endeavor to carry that live here on 1010XL on 92.5 FM. We're live at EverBank. Jaguars Today continues in a moment on 1010XL.
And now, This State in Football History.
All right, This Date in Football History brought to you by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry. Let's start with the events on this date. 1964, January 5th, the Chargers were out the Boston Patriots 51-10 in the AFL title game as fullback Keith Lincoln totaled 349 yards of offense. Back in 1996 on this date, Don Shula, the winningest coach in NFL history, announced his retirement. Famous birthdays for this date. We'll start with a Hall of Fame head coach who lived 82, I believe, when he passed away. Chuck Knoll coached the Pittsburgh Steelers and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1993 as a head coach, won 4 Super Bowls with the Steelers, 9 Central Division titles, compiling a 209-156-1 record and a 16-8 postseason record, which is a phenomenal postseason record. Also born in this date in 1938, Hall of Fame center Jim Otto, Mr. Palindrome himself, 12-time Pro Bowler, 10-time first-team All-Pro, and a Hall of Fame inductee. And from what I could tell, looking at his card on Pro Football Reference today, never missed a game in 15 years with the Oakland Raiders. Pretty amazing. Sam Weish, former head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals, said, hey, you don't live in Cleveland, you live in Cincinnati. He compiled an 84-107 record as the head coach of the Bengals and the Buccaneers combined. He did take the Bengals to Super Bowl 23, where they were leading with 34 seconds left, but San Fran able to thwart them there. Mercury Morris, born on this date in 1947. He turned 69, noted for being a 3-time Pro Bowler, probably the main celebrant every time the final undefeated team loses every year, and for being convicted of drug trafficking as well. Warwick Dunn, born on this date in 1975, the former Seminole Buccaneer and Atlanta Falcon, turns 41, a 3-time Pro Bowler and a 5-time 1,000-yard rusher in the NFL, and the first overall pick in the 2013 draft, Eric Fisher, turns 25 years old, the only guy selected before Luke Jokel a couple of years ago in the NFL draft. This date in football history brought to you by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry. If you're in the market for a family dentist, if you need cosmetic work done, maybe you want the custom fit Somnomed Snorgard, call 620-9225 or visit jamesjmccall.com to get a complete list of comprehensive care services. That is this date in football history.
Now the Honda Drive around the NFL, brought to you by your First Coast Honda dealers.
Well, after a season of speculation from outside the building that Chuck Pagano would not be retained if the Colts fell anything short of a Super Bowl appearance, and that didn't look likely about halfway through the year, Pagano got a 4-year extension to remain the head coach of the Indianapolis Colts after an 8-8 season, most of which they played without star quarterback Andrew Luck. Another set of much more recent rumors turned out to be true. Tom Coughlin resigned as the head coach of the New York Giants. His press conference happening just moments ago. Coughlin was with the Giants for 12 years, won 2 Super Bowls during his tenure, but the team has missed the playoffs the last 4 seasons. Coughlin is currently 12th among NFL coaches all time with 170 wins. He's second among active coaches behind only Bill Belichick with 223.
How'd they do head-to-head in the postseason?
2-0.
TC!
2-0 in the two that count.
TC in the house.
What time did Tom Coughlin's press conference start today?
It was scheduled for 10:30. He started it at 10:25.
And as you, I mean, Tom's just now trolling everybody right now. I mean, that's the classic line about Coughlin. If you're 5 minutes early, you're late to any Tom Coughlin appointment. Jeff, you've told a lot of stories over your time from TC. What if someone who doesn't know anything about the guy, right? Give maybe a football and just a general guy kind of comment. Like, how would you describe what Tom Coughlin meant to you, what he was like as a man, as a head coach? He's not passing away, by the way. You know what I'm saying. It's a significant milestone day for his career. So looking back, if I know nothing about Tom Coughlin, how would you best describe him to me?
Driven. Great leader, driven. Attention to detail, hardworking. I mean, there's so many cliches that you could use with him. Funny. You know, and it's not that he had no sense of humor, but he was funny because he had no sense of humor. I mean, sometimes you had to explain the meaning of a joke to him. But
it's funny you say
made
that.
Made you love him.
You know, I go to the J-Fun wine tasting every year. My wife loves that. And so I think it was not this year, the year prior. My father-in-law played high school sports against Tom Coughlin back in upstate New York, okay? And so, you know, Tom's Mr. Genial, you know, oh, good to see you, Mike. Good, thanks for coming out and got Heather there with me. And he's, you know, thanks for the support of the J-Fund. And she goes, you know, I've been meaning to tell you that my dad wanted to kind of say hello to you, said that he used to play for such and such a high school, and they used to beat your butt all the time, or something to that effect, in high school. And he turned deadly serious. Right? I mean, he went from ha, ha, ha to, I doubt that. That's exactly what he said. And it was just what you're saying. It was kind of meant in a lighthearted way, but he got deadly serious in a second and competitive going back 50 years.
It
didn't matter.
It was always fun trying to get a smile on his face. We had this stupid rule, which, you know, there was a lot of rules, trust me, and a lot of them were stupid. But in 95, when you were hurt, you know, and you didn't practice, you still wore whatever the uniform of the day was. So let's say you had a broken leg, okay, and you're in a cast, you know, from your groin all the way down to the tip of your toes. You had to somehow find a way to wear full pads if it was a full pad day. And you'd be off to the side working with the trainers with whatever the gear of the day
was.
That's
just dumb, right? Tom.
So I'd had a groin in 95 at Stevens Point. And no doubt it was due to the extreme conditioning situations that we were under. But it was still great. And so I wasn't practicing. And you had to wear the uniform of the day. Well, you have to wear your helmet out there. So Bobby Monica, the equipment guy at that time, had one of these old Bronco Nagurski leather helmets. And so I said, you know, in a mild protest of having to wear a helmet on the sideline to do rehab, I wore the Bronco Nagurski leather helmet out to practice. And I got a smile and a laugh out of it. You know, it was good. And here's another story with him this is one of the things that I think small things mean big things to people. We had an extremely hard training camp to where what you were putting in your body was, you know, obviously of the utmost importance because of the need to replenish, refuel. And I was always having to get up early for treatment. And I was always one of the first ones down to get coffee and eat. And so I was there at the same time Tom was most mornings. You know, I'm a light sleeper, go to bed early, wake up early. So I don't know. It was probably the sometime, you know, I reported late, and then after he got over that, you know, sometime after that, and was down there early. And he said, you know, what do you think of the food? And I said, the food is unbelievable. And it was. I mean, it was like five star. Here I was in the baton death march of NFL training camps, and I was gaining weight because I was eating such large amounts of food because it was so good.
Right.
And he said, and I told him that, I said, the food is tremendous. You know, and the chefs that we had there at Stevens Point were outstanding. And I said, but the one thing that's just not good is the coffee. And it wasn't. I mean, coffee sucked. And the next day, I come down, you know, again, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. There is a completely brand new coffee bar. Completely brand new. And I was like, I'll be damned. I didn't see him that morning. I guess he was up even earlier than I was, which wasn't a surprise. And happened to see he comes through the training room that morning, and he goes, comes up to me and he goes, what'd you think? And I said, and I was just joking around because I knew what he was getting at. I said, about what? And he goes, the coffee. I said, it was outstanding, Tom. Thank you very much.
That's pretty good. Attention to detail right
there.
Oh,
yeah. And he always wanted to do what was in the best interest of the player to make sure that they had all the necessary tools to succeed. And if it meant changing the coffee bar, it was the coffee bar. And in that training camp that year, I don't know if you remember, were you here at that point?
Stevens Point, I didn't go to the first training camp, no.
It was the hottest summer on record in Wisconsin. I mean, cows were dying in the field. I mean, it was hot. And we didn't have air conditioning in the rooms. You know, some of the rooms didn't have it at all. I mean, they don't need air conditioning in Wisconsin in the summertime. And we had a budget. Literally, the director of operations had a budget for ice. Literally. Once we reached that budget, no more ice, right? And Tom was going out of his mind because we didn't have enough ice. Because the players, we were taking ice baths. It's the only way to
cool off.
Yeah, to cool the body off and to heal the body for the next practice. And we had literally trash cans and big metal tubs, old cast iron tubs, whatever we could find. And we'd fill them up with ice. And we'd fill them up about 2/3 of the way full with ice and add a little bit of water. And you would literally immerse your total body in these things. And like I said, you were like immersed in a slushy, and that was to help the body recoup and recover. And there was a huge issue, and I think it was John Jones who was the money guy for the Jaguars. You had Michael Hugh, John Jones, Tom Coughlin. That was kind of the structure, you know, personnel, business, football. And I think Tom ended up eating up John Jones' rear end. And by the end of that first week, because we were short on ice, we had all the ice that we could have ever wanted. There was trucks backed up with new freezers and everything to get what we needed.
Spent all that money on Lagerman's coffee, Tony. That's why they didn't have any ice. Are you kidding me? Tom Coughlin.
Well, it's not like he was going to cancel a practice because they didn't have
ice.
He just needed his guys to be ready for the next one.
No.
I got him to rewrite his rule book.
How so?
Well, you know, his rule book was legendary. I mean, he literally, there was attention to detail with everything that Tom does. And he's still that way to this day. I don't believe all the stories that he's backed off. He's the same guy. I mean, we had a dress code for in the hotel. We had a dress code for traveling on the plane. We had a dress code for practice. I mean, there was literally, and it was all spelled out in the rule book. I mean, literally, you got a book at the beginning of training camp, and here's your rules. And he would read every rule word for word to start every training camp. He'd go through the whole thing. It wasn't like, here's...
How long did that take?
Forever. And the worst part was, in 95, you know, we had the early report day. We had the Hall of Fame game, and then he asked everybody to come a week in advance of the mandatory report date, which was 2 weeks prior to the Hall of Fame game. He wanted people to come in a week earlier than that. I told Tom after the last day of the minicamp OTAs, I said, I'm not coming. What do you mean you're not coming? I said, I don't have to. The rule book says you have to be there at such and such a date. I'll be there when I have to. Well, it was me, I think Joel Schmange, Kelvin Pritchett. I think it was three of us. And we were all defensive linemen. And I told those guys, you make your own mind up. I'm not going, but you guys can do whatever you want. And there was others that said they weren't going to come.
And they got a little afraid of that.
And I won't name names on that one.
Everybody else.
Yeah. And so they had gotten, all the guys had gotten there, and Tom reads the rule book verbatim in the meeting. Me, Pritchett, Schmange show up late, the first team meeting that we have. What does he do? He goes through the entire rule book once again for everybody. For everybody. And the whole team is looking at me, Pritch, and Schmange going, thanks a lot. We got to sit through this again because you guys decided to get here a week late or 5 days late, whatever it was. And in that rule book, he had a section about road travel, road wear. And it said that you must wear sport coat, tie, patent leather shoes. Socks are required that match the outfit. You could not wear white athletic socks. So one of the road trips that first year, my great-grandfather, who published in Congressional Record, fluent in, I think, like 7 different languages, lived in Washington, D.C., he was the old style. He wore the old Texas string ties, the bolos. Well, I had a couple of his bolos, and I said, I'm going to wear one. And so I wore one on a road, Texas tie, string tie. And after the road game, I come back to my locker, and we had metal stools in front of our locker. And we knew that you got a fine if there was an envelope on your stool. And they were white stools. We didn't have these nice patent leather reclining chairs that the players of today have. And there's a white letter on my stool, and I open it up and says, you have been fined for a dress code violation. I was like, what? What did I do wrong? So I grabbed the envelope, and walked down the hall, knock on Tom's door, and I said, what is this? He said, you didn't have the proper dress code. I said, what do you mean? He goes, you did not wear a tie on the road. I said, hey, Tom, you're from New York. Do you not have any idea what a Texas string tie or a bolo is? He goes, I've never seen such a thing. I said, that's considered a tie,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, in 1996, the rule book was revised to read, you must wear a cloth tie.
Ah. Well, there you go. Did you have to pay the fine?
Yeah, I ended up paying
it. DC gets you in the end. All right, there you go. Good stuff. Reminiscing with Jeff Loggeman about Tom Coughlin's time here in Jacksonville. We'll get back to the present day. Coming up next, more from Gus Bradley, wrapping up his thoughts on the season. We'll get Jeff's view on what Gus had to say straight ahead. 641-1010, the number if you'd like to get on board. It's Jaguars today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Loggeman, brought to you by Roland Reisch Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, Jaguars Today rolls on here live at Everbank. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, Jeff Loggeman here with you on this Tuesday. And the plan is to have Loggy on every Tuesday right up until we depart for the Super Bowl as we talk about the NFL playoffs, the Jaguars, and I'm sure we'll catch up with you from time to time in the offseason. What other than getting your body right, what are your off-season goals or plans?
Well, that's going to take a pretty good part of it. I got to have a shoulder fixed, I think, that kind of an old injury that just got agitated.
The gift that keeps on giving, the
National
Football League.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be, I think if my count is right, surgery number 11. Mm. So got to get a shoulder fixed, and I'll have a meeting this week and kind of find out when it's going to happen, and I'll be the one-armed bandit for a little while.
There you go. Right.
When do you usually start looking at draft tape, some of the prospects the Jags may be looking at?
Usually in March, somewhere in March, because what you want to do is to allow everything kind of subside and kind of get to where, okay, let me look at the – because basically I'll look at the top 8 to 10 guys at every position. So you want to kind of have something to follow, so you kind of let it kind of play out, so to speak, to where the rankings
who the guys are,
and who they are, and then you can identify who you need to watch. So, and I started doing that, I don't know how many years ago, I remember when Luke Jokel came out, I liked Luke. I definitely liked him better, like Luke Jokel, way better than Fisher. And even to this day, I'd take Luke Jokel over him any day of the week. But I remember the guy that I really liked in that draft, and I think Buscelli and I were also kind of in love with him, was Ezekiel Ansah. Mm-hmm. Well, they were the same draft class, right? Because if I remember right, that was just, athletically, he was just so gifted. And even going back to Jadeveon Clowney and Khalil Mack, and when the guy at NFL Network the draft guru.
Daniel Jeremiah?
No.
Mayock.
When Mayock came out and said that I wouldn't hesitate to take Khalil Mack first overall, I couldn't argue with that, you know, from watching the film. But the only thing that made you kind of go, I don't know, was just the level of competition that Khalil Mack faced versus what Jadeveon Clowney faced. And I still believe that Jadeveon Clowney was the most talented athlete in that draft class. The problem with him now is that he's got a knee that's never going to be normal. You know, he's had a microfracture, and it's going to affect him for the rest of his career. He's never going to be the same player.
Khalil Mack is, oh, my gosh, what a year he had.
You know, and there's certain guys that just can play with that knee bend. Ezekiel Ansah was that way. Khalil Mack's the same way. They can do things physically that others can't do. You know, when I talk like with Andre Branch about the ability to bend knees and play in that bent knee position, Andre Branch doesn't have the physical ability to play like a Khalil Mack or to play like that in that fashion like a Ziggy Ansah. You know, just can't do it. You know, and certain guys have that special trait, and it's very rare to find that.
All right, let's get back to a little bit from Gus Bradley here on the other side of the line of scrimmage, talking about the offensive line. Gus was asked about his assessment of that unit.
First of all, the offensive line. There's some things I look at, like we went from 70 sacks to 50. We were hoping that would be in the 40s. We didn't get it done. But great improvement there. I think Luke Joko, during the season, he's given up 2 sacks, and then yesterday was 5. You know, so it's hard because you want to have a tendency to evaluate the last game, and that's what you build the picture from. But I think that overall the offensive line did a real good job. I think that there's areas we need to be stronger. I think that's what I challenged our team in this offseason. This time, sure, they're going to take some time off, but really physically we need to become even a stronger team up front. And, you know, but pleased with the progress, pleased with, you know, how they've grasped the scheme and the system that we use offensively. And, you know, I think the ceiling is very high for them.
Gus is relentlessly positive, okay? But I think when people hear him say that he felt like the offensive line did a real good job this year, and granted the sacks were down, okay, but still too many sacks, and they really couldn't get the running game going at any point this year. Jeff, how do you feel as a whole – when you're evaluating what the offensive line did this year, how would you respond?
Well, let me correct his numbers. It was 71 to 51, which was a 20-sack less improvement from last year to this year. I think his evaluation is spot on. I think he's very accurate there. He talks about the evaluation of Luke Joko. You can't make it on one game, but you have to include that game in the evaluation. I think that if you don't, then I think you make a mistake. He talks about them with the need to get stronger. And there I think he's talking specifically about the run game and to not stick words in his mouth, but the obvious area they need to get stronger is left guard. And Zane Beatles is, you know, for what they needed and where they were at, I think he was pretty good. But where they need to be at next year, they need to upgrade that position and get a stronger, more physical player at that guard spot. And I think they've already got it on the roster, whether you take Brandon Leonard and put him at left or you move A.J. Cam back to left, you know, or you have Tyler Shatley, also a guy that also could help that strength level if he ends up being the starting center. He immediately is an upgrade in strength from a strength standpoint than Wisniewski. But Parnell was absolutely outstanding, a great acquisition. Unfortunate that he missed the last game with a hamstring that he pulled on the failed 2-point conversion in New Orleans. But I think his assessment is on. I mean, because, you know, if you look at the improvement overall of the offense from last year to this year, it's got to start up front, and it was tremendous improvement. Could do you build the expectations up higher for this year? Absolutely, and you have to take another step.
Gus Bradley, continuing the conversation about the offensive line, was asked if they needed more depth there.
You know, there's certain guys like Luke Boenkel, Shatley, Wells. I think going into the season, we felt like those guys, you know, provide the depth that we needed. And we feel like with another offseason, them getting stronger, you know, we'll see what takes place. But I think in-house, we feel good about their talent level. They just need more experience and to get stronger.
Yeah, the guys that he's really referring to there, the needing to get stronger, is not Shatley. I mean, Shatley's the strongest offensive lineman that they've got, period. You ask any of the offensive linemen who's the strongest offensive lineman, and before you even finished asking the question, Tyler Shatley's getting spit out of their mouth. But Luke Boenkel is a guy, you want to see him make strides and strength, because athletically he is super gifted for an offensive lineman. He's athletic. He can move. He can get to the second level. He's smart, but he needs to develop more strength, and I think the strength is what gave Wisniewski the edge in winning that battle at the center position. Josh Wells, another guy that I think they're referring to about getting more strength. Josh Wells was, when he was playing at James Madison, watching a film of him, you know, he was dominating at that level. It's a different level. At this level here, you know, as an offensive tackle, you need to be 320 range and you need to have some power. And I think that's the one thing that 2 years ago Josh Wells didn't have. And you saw that he made significant gains in training camp this past year. He needs to continue to make strides in that category as well, because athletically he can do it.
All right, moving on with Gus Bradley here, moving off the offensive line. Gus has asked, just in general, is some players should have learned the system better by now? We hear about, you know, making mistakes and not operating things properly and mental errors and these kind of things. So Gus's response to whether or not some players should have learned the system better by now.
Knowing the players, too, and saying, okay, where are we at? What do we have? It's something like what, over the last 2 years, or last year, I think we had, what, 7 draft picks or 8 draft picks and 7 free agents, something. 12 of the 15 guys started for us or played quite a bit, and, you know, whether it was on special teams. So there's some guys that you look at and are new to the system. Then there's those guys that you talked about that's their third year. And I think that knowing the difference, who can you offer flexibility to and, you know, trust them. I think there's, you know, I talk to the players in terms of this. I think when you come in, there's the level of knowing a system. And then you take them up to where it's coach speak, you know, where they know what you're talking about. And then I think the really, really good players take it above coach speak, you know. And I think that's the challenge for our team, is not just to take it to what we're saying, but to take it another level within the premise of the defense, but take it above coach speak. And around the really good players, that's what they do. So I think as we trust these players, we got to allow that to happen. We got to allow them to take it past that.
So, Jeff, when we hear towards the end of the year, right, particularly against New Orleans, we heard this. We heard it this past week as well, that basically guys are not executing their roles, right, the way that they're supposed to. They're not attention to detail wasn't there in some instances. Where does the blame fall for that? Is that on the players? Because, like, you made the example earlier of the Cyprian Gratz play when Grimes caught the touchdown pass. I'm quite sure they're being coached like, hey, in this alignment, this defense, here's your responsibility, here's your responsibility. So is the coaching not doing a good enough job getting that message across? Or is it the players not being able or willing to absorb that, or haven't been able to absorb that? Where does the blame fall when guys are making that kind of mental error late in the season?
Both. I mean, it falls on the coaching and it falls on the players. And this is not the defense that the Jaguars play is not an overly complicated one. And that's why they always talk about play fast, play fast, play fast. Now, it got a little more complicated as the season kind of went on, because they started putting in some things to get pressure, because they weren't getting any pressure with what they had been doing. But that level of complication, it's not like it went from, if you had, let's say, put on a scale of 1 to 100, it didn't jump from 50 to 85. I mean, it didn't do that. You know, it's still inexcusable that week 17, that you have some basic foundation principles. The game in Houston, you had times to where there was misalignments. You had times to where you had, and there's one play that stands out in my mind. It was late in that ball game, and you had Andre Branch and Dan Scuto on the same side. It was a run play that Houston was running close to the end zone, and there was like a mad scramble to get people lined up, and they still weren't lined up right. I mean, to me, that's a problem. You know, that needs to be fixed. That can happen. And another one that happened in a game, it was the Wildcat where Jonathan Grimes ran, lined up in Wildcat in the same type of situation. They were kind of unsure of getting lined up, and maybe it was, and that was a different time, but in that ball game. But it's the same thing. The Wildcat was, they were running it. It's not like you didn't prepare for it. The coaches probably showed it to them a bunch of times throughout the course of the week. That should be clean. It should be a clean lineup and execute, and it wasn't. So for me, that falls on coaching first, and then number two, it falls on the player second. That's got to change.
Gus Bradley also commented on why it's important not to change the schemes and system.
when people say that, or as coaches say that, you're looking for answers. You know, you're looking for answers. So, you know, there's going to be some things that you'll see within the scheme that are different. There's things that we added within the season that were different, and on third down that we haven't done before. So I think that you have your core principles, and then you try to utilize the strengths of your players. If a player is not a good inside technique type player, and he's a very good player for you, then you look to put him on the outside. You know, and you make adjustments. That might not be the scheme, but you have flexibility enough to adjust the players.
All right, there's Gus Bradley, and more from him coming up in our final segment of the program, including Gus answering the question of how close he thinks this team is to where it needs to be. That's straight ahead. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony here with you. It's Jaguars Today live at Everbank on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now more with Jeff Loggeman, brought to you by Roland Reisch Plumbing on Jaguars Today, 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
All right, coming up in a moment, we'll get to the fan feedback spotlight today, asking you for your three keys to victory. Not really. Your three keys to the offseason. Your top three priorities, or what the Jaguars' top three priorities should be this offseason to get where they want to be in 2016. We'll get to that coming up. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony here with you. Thanks, everybody, sending in texts on the Boston's Restaurant and Sports Bar text line. Here's a hypothetical for you, Jeff, and then we'll hear a couple of cuts from Gus. What happens if the Jags start out 0-4? I mean, what kind of a start does Gus Bradley need next year? You know, because people are going to be wondering. There's a segment that thinks Shad Khan made the wrong decision to bring him back, and when you say significant improvement, the clock is going to start ticking in week one for a lot of people. What happens if they get out of the gate slow next year? I mean, is there going to be added pressure, and is this going to become a storyline if the Jags go 1-4 in their first five games?
Well, I hope not. I mean, you hope they don't get into that situation, but I don't think it's going to be about where they start. I think it's going to be about where they finish. You know, because I mean, you look around the league now. Look at Kansas City, what they were able to do, where they rip off like 10 in a row. You know, to finish the season, making a change in the middle of the season accomplishes absolutely nothing in improving your franchise. It's a waste of time. So when you commit, you got to commit. And I think that Shad Khan is smart enough to know that. And if he decides to alter from that, I would be disappointed that he took that route. So I think that next year is going to be a results-driven year, but it's an end-of-the-year results-driven year.
All right, let's get to some more thoughts from Gus wrapping up the season yesterday. He was asked a question I think a lot of people would like to hear the answer to. How close does he think this team is to being where they need to be?
It's never been said as far as expectations, like this number or that. And, you know, I do know, I think, in our conversations, but it's all, I mean, we all know it. We need to improve. And we've talked about that, right? I mean, you heard it from day one. Hey, we got to get better. We have to improve. And, you know, that part of it is still true. I mean, we have to improve. And it maybe went to need to improve, you know, more of a stronger sense that, hey, we've got to really show improvement in all areas. The same thing that took place offensively, let's get that same type of momentum defensively and special teams-wise as well. So are we close? I think we're, you know, what I like about our team is that we've built it through the draft. We've added good free agents, but we've set ourselves up with salary cap-wise in the draft to add another. I mean, if we had 12 of the 15 guys, you know, make significant contributions, and if you can do that again this year, you know, you can get better faster.
Is that realistic to think, though? I mean, is that what they need? Do they need 12 new faces to come in and significantly contribute to this football team?
Well, that's about average, though, I think. You know, if you look at every NFL team from year to year, about 12 is about what it's going to be. I think that would be about right, you know, 10 to 12, somewhere in that range for this team to take a significant step forward. You know, now you're at the point where you're going to start having subtraction of what you built this team from, which is the draft class. You know, it started to happen this year. And next year, there will be draft picks that are going to be let go because you're going to be getting better and better draft picks. You're going to get better free agents. So you've got to make some changes, and the changes in the personnel, they don't have to be significant, but they have to be impactful. There's a difference. There's sometimes to be making a change to make a change, you need to make a change to get better.
The biggest issues we'll see for most of the fans this year in the fan feedback spotlight we'll get to here in a moment is pass rush. Gus Bradley was asked yesterday why Clemens and Branch weren't better than they were.
There's multiple things probably that you look at. I think that's what you analyze in the off season to say, how can we get more production out of that end spot? Sometimes it's the push in the middle. Sometimes it's, you know, the get-off time. You know, is it tight enough coverage to allow them to get there? Is it, you know, is it effort? Is it pass rush moves? Is it utilizing their strengths? You know, so there's a lot of variables that go into it. And, you know, so those are all things we have to figure out in the offseason.
In the bottom line, Jeff, just not good enough players. Is
no.
that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, that's a fact of the matter. You know, and I think one of the big things that impacted that position, which is the Leo position, and I've said this before, that Andre Branch, Chris Clemens, they're not creators. When I say creators, I'm talking about guys that create opportunities for themselves and for others in pass rush. Sendarek Marks, when he was healthy the year before, was a creator. And having him on the field created opportunities for others. And those guys aren't going to create it themselves. And not having Sendarek obviously kind of showed you more of what the true evaluation of Andre Branch and Chris Clemens were. But Chris Clemens also, in that he's got another year under his belt, he's not a young man, and that kind of happens when you get to that point.
Sounds like a guy who speaks from experience. And finally, on this, Gus, talking about staff changes. If there are going to be changes on the coaching staff, how much does Gus rely on Dave Caldwell's input, and does he need his approval to make major changes?
I'll say this. It all comes back to me. It was never a situation where Chad said, hey, Gus, this will happen if you do. That has never been approached. I think that to help you is to better understand Dave and my relationship. Dave and I talk about everything. You know, we have, when I hired the staff initially, I would go in there and talk. Now, he might not know if he's a great DB coach, but he understands people, and he might understand some things I'm going through and say, Gus, I don't know that, but think of this. And it's really no different with him when we talk about personnel and players. So, yeah, we bounce, you know, I think we're very open, very communicative, and we talk a lot about the situations that we're both going through. So will I talk to him about some of the stuff? Yeah.
He's being honest there now. I mean, those two talk about everything. And even in staff changes, like last year, the way I understood it was that because as a coach you don't know everybody, that if Gus was evaluating somebody and there was maybe an insider that Dave would have a relationship with to get more insight on that particular guy, Gus would lean on Dave. And I think it's worked both ways. And you know, the amazing thing is that those two have been working really in lockstep. And that's the first thing you have to have for the organization to have success. And those two do work very well together.
Are their futures tied in the sense that if the team, let's say the team goes 6-10 next year, right? Hope they go 12-4. But let's say they go 6-10 and Sean Conn says that's not good enough. We're going to make a change at head coach. Does Dave Caldwell have more security because he drafted the guy who you believe is the franchise quarterback, which is the most paramount position to have in football?
It's a great question.
What do you – I mean, obviously, your personal guess. What do you – I would think yes. I would think the GM, if he's hit on a quarterback and has hit on some exciting young offensive playmakers – he hadn't hit on everything, clearly, but he hasn't missed on everything either. I would think the GM, as is often the case, gets a second go at it with another coach.
If you have a franchise quarterback.
Right, which I believe they feel they
do.
Yeah,
which, you know, and maybe that is the case, but I don't know that. The only one that can answer that is Sean Conn.
Obviously.
You know, and I also want to say this, is that, you know, I appreciate that, you know, in the National Football League, there's so much rumors, innuendos, speculation that happen around organizations. And with Sean Conn, that has never seemed to be an issue, you know, and I think that is very important for the stability of a franchise. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the decisions that he's made, you know, are going to work 100%. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that the way he conducts the organization business and the way that he keeps things that need to be kept to himself, the way he does keep them to himself, I appreciate that. Because I've been around organizations and I've seen organizations from afar that operate in a very different way. And it doesn't, and when you operate in a very different way than what this organization has done, your chance of success lessens.
All right. Let's look at the fan feedback spotlight today, which, Tony, I have a feeling we could name some of the top priorities that people think are necessary for the Jags to advance this offseason, but that's what we asked you today. What are your top three priorities? What should the Jaguars' top three priorities be this offseason?
From Daniel, number one, all defense, safety, linebacker, pass rush, two, O-line improvement, and third, running back depth and competition. From Joey, get a pass rusher, get a safety or two, get offensive line depth and a center, not a left tackle. He said, hashtag shut up, Mike. That'll go over well. From Duval Doom, number three, O-line. Number two, free safety. Number one, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush. Did I mention pass rush? From Brian, number one, finding a free safety since it's difficult. Number two, fixing the pass rush. Number three, sign Alex Mack. From John, left tackle, defensive end, middle linebacker. From Stoff, number one, pass rusher. Number two, linebackers. 3A, explain why Gus feels Telvin needs to gain weight. 3B, win. From Bill, bring in three top-tier free agents. He mentions Weddle, Mack, and Irvin/Vernon. And draft a free safety, pass rusher, and interior defensive line. Replace defensive coordinator and adjust the scheme. From Eric, defense, defense, defense. DN, safeties, outside linebackers. From Lars, pass rush, pass rush, and pass rush. Hashtag and more pass rush. And from Eric, it's kind of a theme, pass rush, pass rush, pass rush.
Other than personnel, all right, because we talk about safety, linebacker, all these different things. Other than player acquisition, give me one priority. What is one thing organizationally you think they need to do, Jeff, this offseason to compete better in 2016?
I think you need to adjust your staff on the defensive side of the ball. I do. I think you need to, you know, with the opportunities that are going to be given to you, I think you got to take advantage of them. Whether, like I said, whether you reorganize some things, whether you make some additions, you know, and some tractions, whatever that may be, I think you try to strengthen your defensive side of the football. And the other reason why I say that, one is that you're doing it because you want to get better. And you have a great opportunity to compete as a coaching staff, to compete to make your staff better. Number two is that it's not about sending a message, but also it sends the right message. You know what I mean? You're not doing things just for the simple fact of sending a message, but at the same token, it also lets people know, hey, this what we had was not good enough, and we need to be at point A, and we've only been at point Z.
All right, we will end on that note, and I look forward to catching up with you throughout the rest of the month of January, Logs, as we look ahead to 2016 for the Jags. Talk some playoff football as well, which will be fun.
Yeah,
in the weeks ahead.
Looking forward to it.
Have a good week, brother.
You too.
All right, there he goes. Jeff Logman, everybody, at Logs56, LOGS56 on Twitter. For Fat Tony, for Tyler Devitt, and Joe Fortunato, I'm Mike Dempsey, wrapping things up on this Tuesday. That does it for Jaguars Today. XL Primetime coming up next on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Now, Duval, give me two claps and a Rick Flip.
Woo!
That's great job!